Thank you for tuning in to the Helium Radio Network. You are listening to a rebroadcast of a previously recorded show.
Healthcare Confidential debuted nearly 1 year ago on June 8, 2020, 3 months into the COVID-19 pandemic. The show was intended to give listeners insight into the American healthcare system by featuring weekly interviews with healthcare innovators and experts. And that we did, but we also spent a lot of time talking about COVID-19. We couldn't avoid it, nor did we want to. It was difficult to imagine when we started out that nearly 1 year later, the world would continue to be locked in this battle against a deadly virus. Yet here we are. Globally, COVID-19 has sickened more than 150 million people and killed in excess of 3.1 million. Here in the U.S., there are promising signs indicating that we may have finally turned the corner and could begin to see a return to normalcy sometime soon. But around the world, the picture is not as bright. India, for example, is dominating headlines as its healthcare system crumbles under the weight of unchecked spread of coronavirus. And India is not alone. Turkey and Sweden's numbers are high, although unlike India, the positivity rate in those nations is trending downward. Parts of South America are also struggling, with high rates of infection in Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, and Uruguay. In the United States, this week, our average positivity rate dipped below 4%. Earlier in April, that number was close to 6%. New cases in a single day fell to 58,520 this week, a level we hadn't seen since mid-October. And here's more good news. This week, the CDC reports that nearly 145 million Americans, or 43.6% of us, have received at least one dose of the vaccine, while 31% are fully vaccinated. Even better, two-thirds of those over the age of 65 are fully vaccinated. Reflecting on how far we've come is more meaningful when we consider where we were not so long ago. In that spirit, in this episode of Healthcare Confidential, we're going to revisit some of our earlier interviews around coronavirus. In January, Ken Long, Vice President of Administration at Mount Sinai South Nassau Hospital in Oceanside, New York, recalled the overwhelming strain on both healthcare facilities and staff the previous spring during the first wave of the coronavirus outbreak.
Coronavirus changed everything, and I don't think I ever learned more about the infrastructure of an organization than you did during a COVID pandemic. And one very strange example was oxygen. So as I said, we were using a lot of oxygen for the patients on the ventilators. And hospitals typically have an oxygen farm where there's a large tank of liquid oxygen, and that's what feeds the system. We were using so much oxygen that the line was starting to freeze. It couldn't keep up with the demand. And we had to set up a hot water shower above the oxygen tank to keep the line from freezing. And that water ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And then we had to find an oxygen truck, like a tanker truck. I think the nearest one we could find was Maine. And we got that, we brought that here and had that connected to the emergency oxygen connection to make sure that if our oxygen farm went down, we still had a backup system. And we've never even contemplated that before. And talking to some of my counterparts at Mount Sinai, that was a common occurrence for hospitals because we were all being so taxed on our oxygen levels. We had to bring in freezer trucks to handle the amount of people dying from this exceeded our morgue capabilities. And the funeral parlors couldn't keep up. And then there was, as the local governments closed down, they couldn't get death certificates. So that created a logjam. And we ended up having to buy these freezer trailers. We ended up with four of them in order to store the bodies appropriately so that we didn't have them breaking down And it was just things that you couldn't have contemplated happening. A lot of support for the staff. The stress levels were beyond belief. People were exhausted. People were holding cell phones to loved ones so that their family could speak to them because there were no visitors allowed in the hospitals. And I can't even conceive of how stressful that is to be part of those conversations between a family and their loved one who's that sick.
And to do it over and over again, right? It wasn't an isolated situation.
We had, I remember one story here was one of our nurses who lives locally had a Facebook page of the moms of whatever town she lived in. And what she offered them all is if they had a loved one in South Nassau, she would go visit them and FaceTime them so that they could visit their loved one. And it was just thousands of stories like that of things that just kept emerging.
The psychological impact of the lockdown last spring was a major concern for many people. In August, Dr. Martin Lazarets, a psychiatrist in Kirkland, Washington, the site coincidentally of the first major COVID-19 outbreak in the United States, talked with us about the isolation, depression, and substance abuse that increased as a result of the lockdown.
Isolation is very dangerous for all of us. When we're alone, we have no one to share our feelings with, and that makes us more vulnerable to depression, anxiety, sleep disorders, and substance abuse disorders. And that's what's happening. People are abusing alcohol more during this period of time. It's very interesting that when this whole thing first started, liquor stores were essential services.
I did read that, and I did hear one interesting take on that, which is that if you close the liquor stores and, of course, the bars, that alcoholics would all go into withdrawal, and that would also contribute to the demands on the healthcare system at the time when they didn't have the bandwidth to deal with that.
I'm not sure that's why they did it, but it's correct. That could happen.
So I did want to talk about that. I mean, there are news reports from across the country. I've seen reports from Alabama, Tennessee, Rhode Island, to name a few, but all over, that opioid overdoses are on a significant uptick. So what are your concerns about substance abuse, not just opioids, but as you mentioned, alcohol?
Well, whenever there's a crisis and people are under stress, they tend to use the strategies that they've learned, and many people have learned to use substances to deal with their stress. And so, whenever you're put in the stressful situation, they're going to keep using these, and the more stress, the more they're going to need. And especially with a drug like fentanyl, it doesn't take much to kill you. And that's a very dangerous drug. It should never be used as a recreational drug. Not that I'm touting others as recreational drugs, but fentanyl is particularly dangerous because it takes very little to kill you.
As hospitals became overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients last spring, many canceled elective procedures. Patients also became fearful of going to the hospital for other routine and even acute medical issues. The full impact of those decisions is still unfolding and likely will for years to come. In December, Dr. Christopher Rayo, Chief of Emergency Medicine at Catholic Health Service and Good Samaritan Hospital, shared his concerns about how patients were affected by delaying their care.
One of the things that, and I think probably the most upsetting thing that I've seen through this has been that patients who normally would have come to the hospital or sought out medical care for other things definitely did not do that. And if they did do it, certainly not in as timely a manner. And we've seen a lot of patients present to the hospital much, much later in their illness or disease course. And in some cases, unfortunately, they're suffering worse outcomes because of that fear of coming to the hospital. So I think, and I tell them when I see them in the ER, look, my whole staff is basically antibody negative and we're here every day. So this is actually a very safe place. So I think to the community, you know, if you're sick, if you have a medical concern, you should seek care because, you know, we don't want people to suffer from things other than COVID. And we're seeing it. I think now people are starting to seek out that medical care a little bit sooner, which is great. But overall, the volume of emergency department visits across the country really is still down. So we're not back at the level we were pre-COVID.
I am the chairperson for the hospital's vaccine champion committee.
Melody Butler, a registered nurse and infection preventionist at Good Samaritan Hospital Medical Center in West Islip, New York. Vaccines have become a major weapon in our global fight against COVID-19. There are several available. Pfizer and Moderna are estimated to be up to 90% effective at preventing illness. The efficacy of the J&J vaccine, which is preferred by many people because it requires just one dose rather than two, is estimated to be around 72%, although experts say that all three are 100% effective at preventing hospitalizations and death from COVID-19. Just a few months ago, pharmaceutical companies were racing to bring a vaccine to market.
Last September, Melody Butler,
founder of a nonprofit pro-vaccine organization called Nurses Who Vaccinate, shared with us that the FDA would be likely to grant emergency use approval to any vaccine shown to be at least 50% effective at preventing COVID-19 infection.
So there are currently 40 vaccines in clinical trials in humans, and at least 92 preclinical vaccine trials that are still occurring in animal testing labs. So we have about 40 vaccines being done in humans. 27 of them have entered phase 1. 14 of them are now in phase 2. And we have 9 of them that have entered phase 3, basically the last point in the clinical testing period. So what it means for a vaccine to be in phase 3 means that now the scientists are giving the vaccine to thousands of people. And we then just basically have to sit and wait to see how many people become affected. How does it compare to volunteers who were given a placebo? How does it compare? How are the safety measures? How are the effects from it? If we have a vaccine that is shown to be at least 50% effective of the vaccinated personnel, that'll be considered effective as per the FDA, and they will endorse and support the vaccine. And what they're doing right now, they are creating this vaccine in such a mass number that once the FDA approves one of these vaccines based on a very specific timeline, based on a certain number of people who have been tested, then we can open the gates and people can get the vaccine.
Vaccine hesitancy, unfortunately, continues to be a major problem in the U.S., although recent polling indicates it may be waning. A new survey of 732,000 Americans showed a decrease in vaccine hesitancy from 27.5% in January down to 22% in March.
Back in December, Dr. Renata Schiavo,
a senior lecturer at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University and author of Health Communication from Theory to Practice, was unsurprised by the pandemic and also unsurprised by what she called the infodemic, the crisis of misinformation that we're dealing with today.
I think a few of us will be imagining this, but a lot of people, including myself in the field of risk and communication and in pandemics and emerging disease settings have been speaking about epidemic or interpandemic. So we always know that a pandemic or an epidemic will happen. We just don't know when. And of course, COVID-19 has demonstrated how important it is to be prepared on a variety of different fronts.
I just wanted to ask you what you think about the fact that in this country, wearing a mask or not wearing a mask has now become somewhat of a political statement. How did we get here? What do you think about that? What do you make of that?
Well, we are in the midst of an infodemic. This is a term that, as you know, has been increasingly used by the World Health Organization and a variety of different players. So we're also in the midst of a civic literacy crisis and a trust crisis. And all of this contributes to misinformation, and which means that everyone believes the information that is delivered by people they trust. And this issue of civil literacy is especially interesting in infodemic management. Obviously, mask wearing is supported by scientific evidence. But because we are in a civic literacy, and also we have a lot of people who actually didn't have the opportunity to develop high health literacy skills. So we see that there is this politicization of mask wearing, while instead, you know, we know that mask wearing is an important measure to protect everyone against COVID-19.
As we begin to slowly emerge from under the shadow of COVID-19, how will the virus be categorized once it's no longer at a pandemic level? Last summer, Dr. Wayne Lamort, Assistant Dean for Education and Professor of Epidemiology at Boston University School of Public Health, defined the terms endemic, epidemic, and pandemic for us. He also discussed how COVID-19 is similar to and different from the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918.
Well, first, I think we should start off with the term endemic, which really refers to kind of an ongoing baseline level of disease in a given geographic area. So it may fluctuate a little bit within a narrow range. For example, people get colds pretty much throughout the year, but the frequency is very low in the warm months. And an epidemic is an increase in the frequency of disease above the usual endemic rate. When epidemics of a given disease occur simultaneously in many places around the world, that's what we refer to as a pandemic. And I really think of outbreaks as kind of being synonymous with epidemics, although recently during the COVID pandemic, the term outbreak has begun to be used to refer to more isolated flare-ups in COVID in specific communities. You can think of that as kind of an epidemic within an epidemic.
So are there many similarities between what we're seeing now and the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic?
I think there are both similarities and differences. Both pandemics were caused by an RNA virus that humans had not been exposed to previously. And as a result, everyone in the world was susceptible. They're also similar in that both were primarily spread by respiratory droplets, although COVID-19 can also be spread via the true airborne route by tiny nuclei that can remain in the air for several hours. They both cause primarily respiratory symptoms, and in severe cases, both could progress to the ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome, in which the lung sacs fill with fluid that severely impairs oxygenation. And this can also result in scarring and stiffening of the lungs. An overshoot of the inflammatory response to the infection was also common in both the 1918 pandemic and in this one. And that's actually what triggers this development of the acute respiratory distress syndrome. And they're also both similar in that the virus could be spread by infected people before they develop symptoms. One interesting difference is in the pattern of mortality. In the 1918 pandemic, there was what we refer to as a W-shaped case fatality profile, meaning that among infected people, the mortality rates were highest in the very young. Then they dipped down. They were lower in children from, say, 14 to 20. And then they increased again in healthy young adults in their 20s and 30s, then dipped down again in people in the middle ages. and they were then higher again in the very old. In contrast, COVID-19 clearly carries higher risk for elderly people, and particularly those with comorbid conditions.
And we've been just seeing the devastation with COVID and how it's impacted communities of color.
That's Dr. Robert O. Roswell, Associate Dean for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and Associate Professor of Cardiology and Science Education at the Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell. As epidemiologists and researchers tracked COVID-19 infections, hospitalizations, and mortality in the U.S., they noticed a disturbing trend. Black Americans are three times more likely than whites to come down with COVID-19 and twice as likely to die of it. The rate of infection in Latinos has been even higher. In February, Dr. Roswell explained how the pandemic brought these long-existing disparities to light.
It's really important for those that are listening to know that the impacts are happening mostly because of the social determinants of health. So there is not anything, I think, structurally or biologically that's different between Black people, Hispanic people, Asian people, or white people that are causing the differences that we're seeing in the incidence of COVID or the mortality. It's all the social determinants of health. And social determinants of health, I mean, where people are employed, if they're frontline workers and they have to be, they're the necessary workers, who they live with, their socioeconomic status, their education, and all of these tie in to what actually makes Blacks and Hispanics higher risk for contracting COVID. If someone in the family got COVID, how do you think someone who is low income, who lives in a one or two bedroom apartment with the entire family, can they socially distance? And those are the reasons that we see higher incidence in Black and Hispanic communities. Those are the people who had to take the train to come to work while everyone else could work remotely from home on Zoom calls. And then I'll just take this one step further. We should think as a society, since we're looking into these healthcare disparities, why is it so disparate? Why is it that Blacks and Hispanics have lower socioeconomic status, have higher population density in their homes, have less education that leads them to jobs that expose them to higher risk with COVID? I think that's the question we should all ask ourselves. Why are we building and perpetuating a system that perpetuates structural inequities? And when I talk about the structural inequities, is that we build things into policy, whether it's having insurance or getting a loan or where people live or how they're educated and their employment potential. We build that all into the system, and then it produces these horrible negative social determinants of health that impact morbidity and mortality. And then at the end of the day, we ask ourselves, well, why? Wow, this is really bad that this is happening. We have to do something about it. But we do have to do something about it because we created the system that perpetuates all of this. And that's when people talk about structural racism or structural inequities. It's not that there is a one person who's like a very racist person. It could be the implicit nature of designing policy where there was a blind spot and created all of these inequities. And they're so ubiquitous because they permeate policies, initiatives, and the way we function. And so I'm just saying this because I tend to hear people say, well, we talk about racism too much. We talk about structural inequities too much. But we have to realize it's such in the DNA and the fabric of our society that's why we're trying to talk about it, because people have to understand where it exists, because I alone can't do it. Teresa, you alone can't do it. We need people in their jobs and sectors to understand how policies affect people, and so that we can begin to unravel that and disentangle structural inequity and improve these healthcare disparities.
Thank you for joining us this week and listening to this retrospective episode of Healthcare Confidential. New episodes are available on Mondays wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Be well, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Helium Radio. The views expressed by show hosts or their guests are their own and should not be construed in any way as advice from Helium Radio. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our website. Personal perspectives expressed by the producers, writers, and editors will always be presented as such. Any rebroadcast or retransmission without the express written consent of Helium Radio is strictly prohibited. Thanks for listening.